Support for Access Utah comes from Crumb Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Sherry Quinn. Managing plant and animal conflicts was the focus of the Restoring the West Conference held at Utah State University. About 150 wildlife researchers from the Intermountain West gathered to examine issues and strategies for managing coexisting animal populations and plant communities. Bill Ripple, professor of forest resources at Oregon State University, presented a keynote address titled, Using Large Carnivores for Restoring Western Ecosystems. I talked to Ripple about this strategy and wolf behavior.
So let me tell you how I got started on this adventure. I was working as a forestry professor back in 1997, and I became aware that the aspen trees in Yellowstone Park were declining and disappearing, and there weren't young ones to take the place of the old ones. So in 97, I decided, okay, I like mysteries, and there's some controversy, and it's a mysterious situation that the aspen are declining. Let's go out there and find out what's going on. So my graduate student and I, we went out to Yellowstone in 97, and we started coring the trees. So we took this instrument, and we drilled holes in the aspen trees, and then we took out the cores, and we counted the rings. And these rings allowed us to look at when the aspen originated, so we could look at birth dates for the trees. And we found that the aspen trees stopped recruiting or stopped growing larger and regenerating about the 1930s, the early part of the 20th century. So as we're looking through the records, about the different factors of fire and climate and various things that might affect the trees, we found that the federal government killed off the wolves in the 1920s. So at this point, the light bulbs went off, and we started writing and publishing on this theory of called trophic cascades. So that's simply saying that the disappearance of wolves affects their prey, and their prey affects the aspen trees. So the way this works is that wolves prey on elk, and elk like to eat these young shoots that are coming out of the ground, these aspen shoots. So we connected those dots and published that story as a hypothesis, and it was pretty well received. The experiment in Yellowstone continues in that the park decided to bring wolves back in 1995. And reintroduce wolves to the northern part of the park. So here we have a chance to test our theory to see, well, if it's correct, then with wolves back and them preying on elk, and since we think elk are eating the young aspen trees, could it be that with the reintroduction of this predator that aspen will again flourish? Over the last 10 years, we've been studying that response. It's been very interesting. It's amazing to see, but the aspen are now growing again in places. So it's exciting. Its restoration takes a long time, but we are starting to see aspen grow taller and taller and taller in some places. So before wolves, the aspen trees were below my knees, and they weren't able to grow above the browser's reach, which is the elk in this case. Now after wolves, there's many aspen that are above my head, and it's pretty rewarding to see.
How many wolves? Do you have an estimate of the population of wolves in the area?
Well, in northern Yellowstone, the wolves, they fluctuate, the numbers, 40-some to close to 100. And since wolves have returned to Yellowstone, the elk population in northern Yellowstone has dropped from as high as close to 18,000 elk before wolves down to closer to 6,000 today. So a significant drop in the population. So that's what we call a density effect on the prey animals, which is the elk in this case. We also think there's another mechanism that's at play here in northern Yellowstone, and we call this the ecology of fear. So the way the ecology of fear works is that the prey, the elk in this case, become fearful of their predator. So they change their behavior in such a way that we think the results ripple through the ecosystem. And so we think that what we call predation risk or the ecology of fear is also very important in the restoration of Yellowstone. So there's two forces at play: the direct mortality from the predator, affecting densities of the prey, and this ecology of fear that we think affects the behavior of the prey. So, for example, the elk just don't stand around on streamside areas and munch on the plants all day long like they used to. They're more on the move and hiding out in deeper forests and going into the uplands. So the streamside areas are recovering. You know, wolves are controversial animals, and they're tough to live with. There's competition between big game hunters and wolves. It's very obvious. But now you need to be a better hunter if you're competing with wolves, because these elk are very wary. Also, with wolves on the western landscape in more places now, it's difficult for people with livestock, because sometimes wolves will get into trouble and take livestock.
Are we ever in danger of there being too many wolves?
Well, whenever we have a lot of human factors involved, there's always risk with any type of management. But wolves by themselves, like if they're unmolested, wolves have a way of controlling their own numbers. So they're territorial and very social, and the young ones will disperse and go to new landscapes. But if the wolves find themselves too dense and they're too crowded, there will be wolf-on-wolf combat, and they kill each other. The other thing is the wolf population would cycle with the population of the prey. So as they prey on animals and those prey densities decrease, the wolf density would probably decrease with it.
I wanted to ask you, in Minnesota, you said that they're doing pretty well with the livestock industry. And what are they doing that they're able to coexist in a sort of friendly way?
I think one thing that's different between the western states and the Minnesota is that the farmers and ranchers in northern Minnesota grew up as children living with wolves with their parents and grandparents. So wolves were never extirpated from northern Minnesota. They've always been there. And so there's less change to deal with. So these farmers and ranchers developed techniques for dealing with wolves long ago. They might be using things that have to do with non-lethal methods of trying to influence wolves from taking their livestock. And part of it has to do with livestock husbandry, where they do some of their timing, like their calving and lambing. There's certain management techniques they can use to avoid wolf problems. The managers have the option of taking them out if they need to. So they just have a lot of experience. And we're quite naive in the West, and we've been without wolves for many decades, over half a century. So change is going to be tough, I think. That's one of the bigger differences.
Can you talk about the relationship between or amongst wolves and coyotes, and do they live in similar territories?
So I think about coyotes and wolves a lot, and I've studied Lewis and Clark's records of wolves and coyotes, and when Lewis and Clark came through the West in 1803 and 1804, they recorded all the animals that they see, or that they did see, and they saw a lot fewer coyotes than wolves. Now, wolves do not tolerate coyotes because they're too close in body size, and they're both canids. So wolves view coyotes as competitors, and they kill them, or they will chase them off. I think historically, before we had a lot of European settlement in the western United States, and when we had strong wolf populations, I think the coyote populations were much lower than they are today. So when I read what Aldo Leopold writes in his journals, he went down to Sierra Madres in Mexico, and he found that when he went into the mountains and saw the Mexican wolves, he saw virtually no coyotes or very few coyotes. And Lewis and Clark saw a few coyotes compared to wolves. So today on the landscape, most of the western United States is without wolves, but we have a lot of coyotes. Coyotes are at a very high abundance in every western state. We have hundreds of thousands of coyotes roaming the western states, and they are the top predator right now in places that we don't have wolves. I think it's very interesting to ask the question, where wolves are expanding, will they start to limit coyotes? Because pretty much everybody agrees that coyotes are hyperabundant and causing ecosystem problems. So in Yellowstone, after wolves arrived, the coyote population dropped by 50%. And the coyotes changed their behavior to avoiding wolves. So I think the jury's still out as we see wolves expanding in the western United States. And by the way, wolves are expanding. They have a tremendous capability to expand their geographic range. And they can walk and run a long ways just in a matter of days. So wolves are coming. I think the wolves will be here to stay. And there's going to be a lot of management issues that come up. And society's going to have to take a hard look at this. But I think it's going to be an interesting period where, for the first time since the early 20th century, that we now have wolves expanding on the landscape. So these will be very interesting times.
And you mentioned in your talk that grizzly bears and wolves live together, pretty much. How is their relationship?
You know, a lot of times we just talk about wolves, but historically there were what we call carnivore guilds, or a whole suite of predators that were top predators. So we had, on the landscape, we had gray wolves, we had mountain lions, we had black bears, we had grizzly bears, and we had wolverines, which are a little smaller, but they're very fierce. What's interesting in Yellowstone is since the wolves came back and were reintroduced, the grizzly bear population seems to be doing better and increasing. So these grizzly bears end up taking advantage of the carcasses that are left behind by the wolves. So grizzly bears are scavenging these elk kills, and there's sometimes battles over a carcass between a pack of wolves and a grizzly bear. And they're pretty evenly matched. It can go either way as to who wins the carcass. Sometimes the grizzly bear just lays on top of the dead elk, and the wolves kind of just hang around on the edge, and they just do a waiting game. But the bears are very ferocious, and wolves respect them.
That was Bill Ripple, professor of forest resources at Oregon State University. For Access Utah, I'm Sherry Quinn. Stay tuned for Science Questions up next.
This is a special UNICEF radio podcast on education in emergencies and post-crisis nations. I'm Amy Costello. Kosovo has a long history mired in ethnic and religious conflict. Border disputes remain an issue of intense debate even to this day, and Kosovo is also Europe's youngest region. More than half the population is under 25, and there are few economic opportunities for these young people. Against a backdrop of historical ethnic divides and a weak economy, in Kosovo's capital, Pristina, young people from different backgrounds are getting together on a regular basis. They meet at the Innovations Lab Kosovo, which UNICEF sponsors. Young people from across the ethnic and religious spectrum get the chance to harness technology and their own creativity to contribute to positive social change. Today we'll speak to three young people who have firsthand experience working in the Innovations Lab. Ron Solly is the lab's project coordinator. Sophie Maureen is a volunteer at the lab, and Milica Milovic is the creator of a program that she designed and implemented called Recycle Smart. She told me how her project aims to encourage young people from different backgrounds to work and live together.
It's actually an environmental project about recycling. But the thing is that we didn't do only environment. These workshops also bring different kind of people together, as well minorities and majorities. So in a way, even if we didn't talk about the peace, it was in a way like peace building and peace education.
And in what ways is just bringing people together into the same room? How is that peace building in your mind?
Personally, in my mind, is like we don't need to talk about the peace to build the peace. For me, peace building means that you bring people together to work on some issue, and in that way you actually show that it's possible that people can live and work together. The obvious thing, if you are doing some recycling, making the wallets, and all the people are talking about environment, they are actually not aware that this is the way of peace building in a way.
And Milica, can you think of one example? Was there one moment during this project where you saw a few young people from different backgrounds working together and you realized, wow, this is really working? Or was there a particular person who came in who you saw really change as a result of working with people from different backgrounds?
Yeah, I can say that most of the workshops I was really surprised and I was really happy, because there was really one specific moment when the kids from Fushkosova, it's a small village close to Pristina, it's like Roma and Ashkali or Egyptian kids, came, and then also other Roma kids from Plemetina, and there was Albanian and Serbian people from Pristina. So in one moment I just realized that we was talking in three different languages, and it was really beautiful to see this diversity of the languages. We was talking about the environment in all languages just to understand each other.
Sophie Maureen, I know that you have come to Kosovo from France. I'm wondering, what have you observed about what's going on in this lab with young people from different backgrounds coming together? What has surprised you the most about what you've seen there?
Well, many things are surprising me. I'm still actually, even without expectation, I'm still really surprised by the diversity and learning more about the situation and what happened and the harms that has been done to some people, and actually seeing now young people really leaving that behind them in a way. More and more young people are really willing to move forward and interact with each other and try to talk with each other. I mean, as Milica was saying, I took part in some of the workshop, and the mixity and the diversity of participants and the way they interact is really, really positive. And it's really giving hope for the future in Kosovo.
And so when you look at these young people in these labs working together quite cooperatively, but then you go out on the street and you maybe go to other places where you see adults and older people who seem unable to live side by side, to be friends with one another. I mean, why do you think there's a difference between what the young people are doing in the lab versus the reality on the ground outside on the streets with an older generation?
I think it's easier for young people to move forward. There's a part of their life is in front of them, and they have this capacity to adapt and adjust and forgive and move forward because they do want to build their life. While maybe for older generation, it's a bit harder to live with the scar of the past, to adapt and to forgive, and they're not at the same stage in their life, so that might be an answer.
Mm. Ron, I know that you go out to the rural areas to meet with young people. And do you see a difference there between the ethnic relations between people in rural areas compared to there in the urban areas?
Basically, the main challenge of the Innovations Lab now in the beginning is to reach out most marginalized or most excluded communities, which means youth and women from rural places, but also Roma, Serbian communities here in Kosovo, and to bring at the lab and to make together and to raise their voice for their problems that they face daily.
Ron, I've read that just 75% of children who complete ninth grade actually go on to enroll in high school. And I'm wondering, working with young people as you do, why do you think so many children fail to complete high school?
I think that government is not acting as they should act to deal with this problem, but also the families are quite limited due to economical problems.
And Milica, I had read that the rates of finishing high school is even lower for girls, that Kosovo Albanian girls, less than 55% of them finish high school. Why do you think that finishing high school for girls in particular is a problem?
I will not say that now this is actually an issue. Maybe in the past it was. I think that it was part of the culture and tradition, actually. Because usually woman was considered as a person who's supposed to be married, have kids and stay in home. So why would a woman will have a school, yeah? But now it's more and more really women who are going not only to high school, but also finishing the universities more.
And why do you think that's changing?
Why? I think one of the reasons is also that Kosovo is the youngest country in the world. And I think that this youth bring the power of also to change things. So I also believe that Kosovo is like a new developing country as well, but also with a good energy and looking in a future more than in the past.
Sophie Maureen, Ron Sali, and Milica Milovic, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
This has been a special UNICEF radio podcast on education in emergencies and post-crisis nations. I'm Amy Costello.
Regional correspondents on Utah Public Radio provide that unique link that makes UPR's statewide news coverage your favorite resource for news. Hi, I'm Mackenzie Hamilton. Join me each evening during All Things Considered at 5:30 for expanded Utah news. UPR has a one-of-a-kind network with reporters from Southern Utah, the Uinta Basin, Moab, and Utah County. It's the only way of providing you with the views and news that you need to make informed decisions. Utah Public Radio, your favorite public radio station for statewide Utah news.
Support for Science Questions comes from USU's College of Science, advancing the educational experience of future scientists with advanced research in the lab, field, and outer space. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information is at usu.edu/science.
Welcome to Science Questions. I'm Susie Montgomery.
And this is Sherry Quinn.
I feel good about it. I really do. I really feel good about the wolves coming back.
Unlike most other ranchers, 84-year-old Floyd Cox from the Uinta Basin is happy to see them again. He has seen them 3 times in his life so far.
My dad tells me a story that we was up after woods with a team of horses. The horses strayed away from the wagon, and he went down to get them, and then I thought this dog was coming in, and it was a wolf. Whoa. And so Dad heard me hollering, and he came running up there, and I think that wolf was after me. I was there by myself. And that's when I was a little small guy. And that was the first wolf I ever seen, and I was scared. He was too aggressive to be a dog. But that's what it looked like to me at that time. Seen dog, but he was a huge dog with a big head.
Fear of the wolf and pressure from the livestock industry has put them back in danger.
The Northern Rockies population of wolves was removed from the Federal Endangered Species Protection in 2011 due to bipartisan connivance in Congress and hostility from the Obama administration, moving the struggle for wolf recovery to the individual states. Wolves are being hunted and trapped and killed by the hundreds already in Montana and Idaho. Utah doesn't yet have a resident population of wolves, and any that have wandered in have been trapped and are shot.
This delisting of wolves from the Endangered Species Act allows the state of Utah to kill wolves that are in groups of two or more within the designated recovery zone, which is the corner of the state north of I-80 and east of I-84. Outside of that zone, any wolves migrating to Utah remain protected, at least for now.
The Northern Rockies population of wolves was removed from Federal Endangered Species Protection in 2011 due to bipartisan connivance in Congress and hostility from the Obama administration, moving the struggle for wolf recovery to the individual states. Wolves are now being hunted and trapped and killed by the hundreds in Montana and Idaho, and Utah doesn't yet have a resident population of wolves, but any that have wandered in have been trapped and are shot. Conservationists like Kirk Robison see wolves as apex predators, essential to the balance of nature, keeping browsers such as elk and deer on the move to avoid overgrazing.
I'm really interested in wolves, and I'm the executive director of Western Wildlife Conservancy here in Salt Lake, and I've been working on wolf and other large predator issues for over 20 years now.
Do you have any hopes for wolves in Utah?
Yes, I do, but I think we're going to have to work hard for that because our politicians don't want them.
Anything imminent right now going on politically that needs to be addressed?
Yes, as a matter of fact, we are told that the Fish and Wildlife Service is planning on delisting wolves throughout the entire lower 48 states early next year, except the Mexican gray wolves in Arizona and New Mexico, which are struggling, and some small population in Washington and Oregon. And if that happens, that means Utah will probably never have wolves.
I met up with Robison just before a talk by wolf expert Carter Niemeyer at the Tracy Aviary in Salt Lake City. A peacock roamed up and down the sidewalk, jumping up on the picnic table as people filed in.
I wish there were more younger people here. I don't see enough younger people. Mm. By younger, I mean like below 40. Mm-hmm. but even below 30, you know. And I'm kind of disappointed in that. I don't know what the explanation is.
Do you think it's the sort of passion for animals, or do you think this issue is more driven by conservation efforts?
Well, you know, people either seem to love wolves or hate them. Not very many people are indifferent. And I think the people that are coming to this like wolves. And that's why they're here.
Is that why
you're
here?
And I think, yeah, that's part of it. But also, I do have an ecological grasp of the importance of wolves. And I think a lot of these people do too, because since they're interested in wolves, and wolves have been around in the West now for some time, there's been a lot of information published and broadcast about the role of wolves in ecosystems. And I think most of these people pick up a lot of what we're learning about the wolves in Yellowstone and what they've done to benefit the streams and rivers there and other things.
Ecologist William Ripple of Oregon State University began studying the eradication of the gray wolf from Yellowstone National Park in 1997. He and his colleague, Robert Beshta, concluded the entire park's ecosystem changed because of it. Elk populations were rising and aspen trees were declining. A dozen years later, since the return of the wolf, recovery is underway for aspens and also in birds, fish, and insects.
Since they are a native species to Utah, and if they keep the ecosystem in balance, why shouldn't wolves be allowed to migrate naturally to Utah from Yellowstone? Wolf watching brings $35 million a year to the Yellowstone area, and Robison hopes Utah will also eventually turn to wolf tourism, instead of trapping and killing them. The Uinta Mountains and the Tavaputs Plateau are obvious candidates for wolf habitat, as are the Tushar Mountains, Bear River Range, Boulder Mountain, Wasatch Plateau, and Navajo Mountains.
In fact, Floyd Cox had his second and final wolf encounter in the Uinta Mountains near Tabiona about 15 years ago.
My dad, we was up deer hunting with my dad and my brothers, and we come to an old sawmill, and we looked down, way, way down, and it was a steep canyon, and there was a pack of wolves down there. And the front one was wide, way wide, but the back one's narrowed in, like when they'd surround their prey, and then when they'd turn to run away, they'd run back into the pack. And they're all colors. They look different. They come looking different. And the snow was deep, but they got along with it very well and got through it. Then another time, we was deer hunting up the Hannah, and there was a guy yell up on the hill, "Wolf, wolf, wolf." And I could hear him, but I couldn't see no wolf. And I come up on my horse, and there was a big wolf sitting right on the bank where I had to cross. And of course he ran when he saw me, but that was my third encounter with a wolf.
These kinds of stories are inspiring to Bob Brister, membership coordinator for the Utah Environmental Congress. He's working round the clock towards making Utah more hospitable for wolves.
And I also run the wolf recovery campaign for the Utah Environmental Congress to get wolves back here in Utah where they belong.
Why is that important to you?
Well, for a number of reasons. Wolves are very important ecologically. They're what's called an apex predator, so they help keep nature in balance by their interactions with other species. They prey upon, for example, like elk and deer. They keep what they call ungulates, animals that graze, on the move so that the elk, for example, don't eat up all the aspen shoots coming up in one spot, for example. So wolves are very important in keeping the whole ecology in balance. Also, wolves are fascinating animals. If you've ever seen one in the wild, you never forget it. And they're very charismatic and beautiful and magnificent animals. And I think they have a right to exist just for their own sake. And, of course, for us, too, because we get to enjoy them.
They belong here, too. Just like they was here before us, and they should be here all the time. But, of course, sheepmen and cattlemen don't like them.
Many of them are deathly afraid of wolves.
Bless his heart for thinking that. You know, I don't care if you put a freight train in here and that runs over him, then we fight freight trains.
That is sheep herder Chad Edgington from Huntsville. He herds sheep in the Wasatch Mountains east of Ogden.
I don't understand the other side of the story. I don't understand the mystique of hearing a wolf howl at night or, you know, do whatever wolves do. They kill and they're big and they eat a lot. And when they get into your livestock, you know, they kill them. And not only do they kill them, they scare the heck out of everything that they didn't kill. And they don't settle down. They hear the wind blow, they hear a tree crack, they hear anything, and they're always looking over their shoulder wondering because their brother just got killed.
I mean, it's so emotional here.
Allison Jones is a conservation biologist for the Utah Wild Project. She helped write the first state management plan for great wolves.
People just, you know, screaming that the sky is falling. I mean, hysteria, really. The wolves are decimating the Idaho elk population, things like that. In the Northern Rockies, about 2.3% of sheep deaths that are unplanned, you know, not being slaughtered for market, are because of wolves. And about 0.11% of cattle deaths. So what this means is out of all the unwanted deaths of sheep, for example, in Idaho, Wyoming, and Montana combined, actually 23% of those deaths are because of coyotes.
Carter Niemeyer was a member of the team that reintroduced wolves to Yellowstone in 1995. He was the head of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Wolf Recovery Program in Idaho. He retired in 2006. When Niemeyer walks into a room, he doesn't go unnoticed. A far over 6 foot blonde with a sense of humor and a serious message about the war on wolves. Once an expert wolf hunter, he recently published a memoir titled Wolfer that describes how he went from a killer to a protector.
And it's a memoir that I wrote about my career with the federal government as a wildlife biologist managing predators, and it kind of addresses a lot of the issues about wolf management also, and that's going on currently in the Northern Rockies.
He knows as much about wolves as anyone, and he's probably had more hands-on experience with wild wolves as anyone in the country. So we were anxious to get him here to talk about wolves, to share his experience, and to separate fact from fiction, because there's a lot of myths about wolves out there.
We've successfully recovered wolves. They're now viable. And as a consequence, they've been delisted from under the Endangered Species Act protections. And we have hunting and trapping seasons for them. So there's kind of an irony that we recovered wolves and now we're busy killing them again.
Why are you doing what you're doing now that you're retired?
Well, we have a whole new crop of biologists and we have a whole new crop of citizens who aren't really aware, I think, of some of the issues that were relevant at the time we did the wolf reintroduction into the Northern Rockies, and so we're educating a whole new audience.
And so you feel it's just a job that needs to be done?
Yeah, I think my job isn't finished yet till I at least get some people in a comfort zone that they understand what's going on.
Okay, and do you have advice for other wolf advocates? You have a crew of about 60 people in there, and do you have some advice for them?
Well, it's important that they be informed and be active, and I think they need to recruit a lot of followers in order to have some political say in the way things are going.
He's dealt with wolf issues all over the world, including England, France, and Kyrgyzstan.
Well, the wolves are in Kyrgyzstan. It's a former Russian republic, and people there are very poor and live on meager resources, so a wolf there that kills a sheep might be destroying a child's college education. It's that kind of environment.
And were you trying to protect them and figure out other ways?
We were trying to find ways that farmers in that poor country could coexist with wolves and give them some simple measures to protect their livestock.
Despite retirement, Niemeyer is not stopping. He says it's too dangerous. Now more than ever, he works to dispel the persistent big bad wolf syndrome that propels many Westerners to shoot these canines at sight.
And
that drives him to give talks across the nation.
I don't think the wolves have a problem, I think people have a problem. it's man's world, and we got to find places where nature can fit in and the ecology can still function.
During his talk, Niemeyer explained how ranchers and guiding outfitters detest the wolf.
And so
they want to eradicate it.
Absolutely misunderstanding.
Lifestyle.
There's fear, and then there's purposeful misinformation going out where the locals are trying to be, they're trying to play the victim card. This is affecting us, it's destroying us, it's wiping out our businesses, it's destroying our ranches. And of course, the federal government did it. You can't trust the federal government. This is our state. The state belongs to us.
The success of the wolf recovery program instigated cultural shockwaves in states like Wyoming. Yet there have only been 2 human deaths from wolves since wolf recovery in the Northern Rockies, Alaska and Saskatchewan in Canada. No one has been attacked or killed by a wolf in all 48 states.
Look on the internet about dog attacks each year to humans in the United States. It will stagger you. You're talking thousands and thousands of dog bites, probably 30 or 40 mortalities a year by Fido, who you go to bed with and lock your door with him inside and not outside. So again, human health and safety, wolves, I wouldn't spend a lot of time worrying about.
Keeping them out of livestock is the biggest worry, and that makes humans their worst enemy.
The most vulnerable thing about wolves are humans kill them. And if we kill them and persecute them, we can persecute them right back into serious trouble again.
The state of Wyoming is about to cause problems again for the survival of wolves in the region.
80% of the state is going to be opened up to killing wolves any way possible with no restrictions. The downside to remember is you kill those 40 or 50 wolves out in that 80% of Wyoming, that really cuts off those dispersers who connect with Colorado, Utah, and other places. So that's the detrimental part.
The rarest wolf, the Mexican wolf, is not immune to the threats.
And going into spring, we had like 52 of them left. There's supposed to be about 100 or more by now, but same situation. Even as rare as these animals are, the livestock industry is doing their level best to have that whole project terminated, put them in a zoo and forget it.
And like the Mexican wolf, the gray wolf faces an anti-wolf policy in Utah. Susie interviewed conservation biologist Allie Jones about their uncertain fate.
We don't know right now how many wolves are in Utah. At any given time, there's usually a couple stragglers coming through. A number of the Yellowstone wolves still have those GPS collars. The folks at Division of Wildlife Resources have sent us data showing the GPS collar hits for wolves coming through the state and leaving again. We're pretty sure there's not a breeding pair that have set up shop anywhere or a pack. The folks, at the Division of Wildlife Resources are pretty good with sharing that kind of information. We did have a couple instances last year of wolves coming into Rich County in particular, got in a bad way with some sheep. That wolf was killed, another one spotted and ran off not to be seen again, but if it was seen again, it would have been shot. They're here. We haven't heard too much this year so far in terms of wolves getting into trouble in Morgan or Rich County or anywhere else with livestock. So I think they're coming through and they're being good. I think they're sticking to native prey. And I think it's just a matter of time before we see a pack established somewhere. I hope it's outside of the DPS, though.
So in that area, that swath called the DPS, right now you can shoot wolves at large. Or you just go ahead and shoot it. It's totally fine because of that rider.
And that's a really good question. You can shoot it. Can I shoot it? Can you shoot it? Well, SB 36 didn't speak to that. That's a great question. We should ask the Division of Wildlife Resources about that. My suspicion is, if a wolf showed up in the DPS tomorrow and whoever happened to have a gun, a rancher or their hire or anyone passing through saw it and shot it, that'd be perfectly fine. But SB 36 is silent to that. That's the problem with legislators managing our wildlife like this. There's a few specifics left out.
And then otherwise in the state, it's completely illegal because it needs to be condoned by the federal government.
Exactly. So you'd be in trouble outside of that. There, you know, will be wolf hunting in any state in the future that has healthy populations. And I think the conservation community has to just be okay with that. There's just no way around it.
Vision of the sort of a wolf utopia?
Well, to start with, we would love to get a healthy population of wolves in the Uinta Mountains. The Uintas has a very large wilderness area they can live in, lots of deer and elk to eat, and actually a tourist industry built around wolf watching could be developed here in Utah, just like it is in Yellowstone. People spend $35 million a year to see wolves in the Yellowstone area. It seems to me that Utah would want to get a piece of that action.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for your time, and sure. I'm looking forward to this evening.
So. Sure, me too.
So be optimistic. We've got wolves in more places, and the most furthest southern extension in nearly 80 years. So it's a good situation. Wolves are coming back. Wolves are here to stay if we as humans manage them in a sensible way.
So I feel good about the wolves coming back. They're a predator, but wolves are intriguing to me. You see wolves' heads everywhere. They're a symbol.
They're beautiful, huh?
Yeah, they are. Yeah, oh, yeah. And they're arrived at being a beautiful animal. And they are. They're a symbol. Even more than any other thing on that I see in my house, I have symbols of wolves on blankets and things. That's a symbol that a lot of people recognize, and they recognize it right away. You see that more than on anything else of any other animal that I can think of. You never see one, hardly ever coyotes or bears, sometimes polar bears, but not very often.
The Utah Environmental Congress is collecting postcards in support of wolf recovery to send to Utah Governor Gary Herbert. Since March of this year, they have collected and sent 428 pro-wolf postcards. The UEC also encourages people to write to Obama, asking him to allow gray wolves to migrate naturally to Utah and to stop the hunting and trapping of wolves in the Rockies. You can visit their website at uec-utah.org. Next, we travel to Seattle, Washington, to present the third installment of KUOW's More Than a Tree series. Meet Ginkgo biloba. It's a common street tree in Seattle, but its reproductive cycle is anything but ordinary. Like humans, ginkgos have free-swimming sperm. Producer Sarah Waller introduces us to two ginkgos near Green Lake Park and talk birds and bees with tree expert Arthur Lee Jacobson.
Some of you may become somewhat uncomfortable as parts of this unfold, but I think, unless you're an extremely unusual audience, you will welcome some of this insight.
They stand side by side. One's tall, the other's more slender. They lean in towards each other, almost touching. There's a reason why Arthur Lee Jacobson has taken me to this particular spot.
There's only a handful of places in Seattle where you can see both a male and a female together.
We're talking about trees, ginkgo trees. You can pick them out by their triangular fan-shaped leaves. Ginkgos are very common in Seattle, but they're capable of some pretty uncommon things. Arthur has written about them in his book, Trees of Seattle. He says the first thing that sets ginkgos apart is their sex. Most trees are what scientists call monoecious, meaning a single tree that has both male and female parts.
Most trees are bisexual, but there are a minority of trees, maybe 10 or 15%, where they're strictly male or they're female.
And ginkgo trees are one of them. So which one is which here?
The female is definitely broader, just like human females, at least the hips are broader, but the male is slender. It's sort of like with a human, the reproductive parts are what you look at.
So we did look at them. And just like your human sexuality class in junior high, Arthur's description of ginkgo anatomy gets a little graphic.
The boys have these dangling things that release the pollen, and the females have these little things about the size of a radish seed that are glistening and wet, saying, pollen, come here, in tree language.
The parallels between human and ginkgo tree sex get even stranger, especially when you take a microscopic look at the male reproductive cell, a grain of pollen.
Unlike most plants, it's more like an animal. It can crawl or swim or whatever.
Ginkgos are the only trees with free-swimming sperm. Here's how it works. Wind blows pollen from a male tree onto the sticky part of a female tree. Those sticky parts are attached to egg cells. When a grain of pollen lands, it releases two sperm cells. Like human sperm, they can swim. They head straight for the egg. The fastest sperm fertilizes the egg, and a new ginkgo embryo begins to form. It's surrounded by a soft, fleshy substance called sarcotesta. It looks like a fruit, but is actually a nut. And that fleshy nut is the reason why most ginkgo trees in Seattle are male.
It's rare to find female ginkgos because most people think the fruit is messy and it stinks.
One of those people is Marisi Nirad. She owns the house next to these two ginkgo trees. She likes them, but sometimes they can be a nuisance.
Because the fruit, when it's on the ground, smells.
What's it smell like?
Well, it smells like someone has thrown up.
Vomit, a bad body odor, dog poop. You get the idea. It's disgusting.
It really, it's not a particular good smell.
Because of that odor, most people plant male trees. People like them because they're gorgeous in the fall. Both sexes turn a bright butter yellow. And they're resilient. They make great urban trees because they can tolerate high levels of air pollution. They've even been known to withstand an atomic bomb. Six ginkgos were among the only living things to survive near Ground Zero in Hiroshima. In fact, these trees are considered living fossils. They've been around for millions of years.
When there was still dinosaurs and tall ferns and horsetails everywhere, the ginkgo was here. It's a survivor, and that commands respect.
Maybe it's the ginkgo's resilience and longevity that make it a popular health food. you'll find ginkgo biloba on the herbal remedy aisle of most grocery stores. Some people say it boosts memory. Other people claim it's an aphrodisiac, which brings us back to the topic of sex.
We have tried to bring out facts not well understood and tried to explain them on a scientific basis.
So next time you pass under a tree with distinctive fan-shaped leaves, look up. A courtship between an egg and a wiggly-tailed tree sperm may be taking place right over your head. I'm Sarah Waller.
Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn, Susie Montgomery, and Elaine Taylor. Thanks for listening.
Support for Science Questions comes from Apogee Instruments of Cache Valley, creating innovative sensors for measuring climate change, sustainable food production, and renewable energy. More information is at apogeeinstruments.com.
Welcome to the Beehive Archive, a two-minute look at some of the most pivotal and peculiar events in Utah's history. I'm Megan Van Frank. The Old Hotel Utah has a storied history of hospitality that is shadowed by the racial prejudice common throughout Utah right into the 1960s. Learn more after this.
The Beehive Archive is brought to you on Utah Public Radio by the Utah Humanities Council, with support from a We the People grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Lawrence T. and Janet T. D. Foundation.
Located on South Temple and Main Street in downtown Salt Lake City, the venerated Hotel Utah was known in its day as the Great White Palace. It hosted heads of state, United States presidents, and Hollywood greats. Yet when the internationally celebrated opera singer Marian Anderson made a concert stop in Utah in 1937, she couldn't find a hotel room. Anderson was African American. When she returned a year later, the Hotel Utah relented, as long as she used the freight elevator and didn't eat in the public dining room. Anderson's experience was one of many Utah examples of racial discrimination that also included other noted entertainers. Paul Robeson, Harry Belafonte, Ella Fitzgerald, and Lionel Hampton were all directed to the back elevator and ate meals in their rooms. In 1954, Frontier Magazine compared discrimination in Utah, Nevada, and Arizona with the American South. This was despite a 1948 Utah law making it a misdemeanor to refuse service to blacks. During this time, Utah Realtors attempted, but failed, to create segregated neighborhoods in Salt Lake and Ogden. In 1955, Marion Mills, an African-American military veteran, wrote to the Salt Lake Tribune complaining that blacks were required to occupy balcony seats in many local theaters and that certain jobs in Salt Lake were unavailable to blacks, as were most nightclubs and bars. Mills could have also mentioned that hospitals restricted black patients to private rooms and kept separate the plasma of blacks and whites in their blood banks. Utah passed even stricter laws against interracial marriages during the 1950s. When these laws were repealed in 1963, the state barely beat out Wyoming, the last western state to abandon its interracial marriage laws. The African-American population in the Beehive State has grown markedly since then, and the days of the Great White Palace are gone, in more ways than one. But is Utah truly free from discrimination? Research and writing for this episode of the Beehive Archive were provided by Rebecca Anderson. Sources and past episodes may be found at utahhumanities.org. For the Beehive Archive, a production of the Utah Humanities Council, I'm Megan Van Frank.
Thank you for listening to Utah Public Radio. This is KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan. This is Utah Public Radio, Utah's favorite public radio station.